Welcome to episode 5 of the Dean's Podcast, the podcast about issues shaping graduate studies in Canada. This podcast is brought to you by University Affairs Magazine. My name is Carolyn Waters, and I'm the Dean of Graduate Studies at Dalhousie University in Halifax, Nova Scotia. I'm also the president of the Canadian Association of Graduate Studies, CAGS, for the year 2009. Every month you can listen in as I talk to other deans, faculty, postdocs, and graduate students about where graduate studies is going in Canada and internationally. In this episode, I talk with Kevin Vesey, Dean of Research and Graduate Studies at St. Mary's University in Halifax, about CAGS' recently published Guiding Principles for Graduate Student Supervision. Kevin, who was the lead author of these principles, explains where the idea came from and the whys and hows of student-supervisor relationships. Finally, he takes us through each of the 12 guiding principles and their rationale and makes some really useful comments on next steps that graduate faculties can take. First, a message from our sponsor, University Affairs.
Hi, my name is Dick Sultantaz, and I'm responsible for all career advertising in University Affairs. Did you know that most graduate students don't know where to look for academic jobs? Simply because their supervisors haven't told them. Tell the PhDs and postdocs you advise to visit www.universityaffairs.ca for the latest job offers in every discipline. It's free and it's updated daily.
Okay, I'm at St. Mary's today with Kevin Vesey, who's the Dean of the Faculty of Graduate Studies and Research at St. Mary's University in Halifax. Kevin was the chief author of a report for CAGS last year on principles for graduate student supervision. So who better to talk to us about student supervision than Kevin? So welcome, Kevin. Maybe you could give us a little briefing on why you were interested in this particular topic.
Sure. Thanks, Carolyn. The CAGS every year or two take on a topic they're interested in exploring, something that has wide application across the country. And it was actually at an annual general meeting a couple of years ago. I wasn't on the executive at the time. And, you know, under any other business, they ask, has anybody got any interesting things to talk about? And I put up my hand and I said, why don't we put together a document on guiding principles, something that we could all look to for on graduate student supervision? And they said, well, thank you. We'll take that under advisement. A year later, I'm on the executive and it comes up, well, let's pursue one of these documents and look through the notes. And hey, this Vesey guy thought this was a good idea. And so that's how basically I got involved with leading on this.
So lesson number one, keep your head down.
Exactly. Yeah. Put up your hand at your own risk. But I mean, the driving force why I put my hand up in the first place was that, you know, there's many good documents out there within departmental websites and student handbooks, so on and so forth, on graduate student supervision. And I got to say, at the outset, when we put this working group together, we probably bit off more than we could chew. We thought we'd actually put together a comprehensive manual on graduate student supervision. And we saw, when we started doing our work, looking at the diversity of this issue across the country, that there was no way we could put together a specific manual that could apply to all locations, all disciplines, so on and so forth. So the idea of the guiding principles came forth. And when we did that, that made a lot more sense. So really, the idea of the document is so that people like you and me, and right down to graduate students and supervisors, can use this document as a guide, as something to try to achieve in terms of a good relationship between supervisor and supervisee.
So before we get to the document, maybe we could talk a little bit about what's the problem. Why, we've been supervising people for eons. Why do we think we have a problem with this? Who's losing out?
Mm-hmm. as a fellow dean, you will know that problems do happen, and they end up on our desks. So in some ways, this was a little self-serving to put this together. But there's an awful lot of good supervision that goes on out there. Some of it, people just have an innate capacity for it. Others, you know, because it's, you know, there is no graduate student supervision training for professors as they go through their graduate degrees. It's not intuitive to people. And so we learn a lot from our own supervisors going through grad school. We may have good mentors in our departments whenever we come on as junior faculty, so on and so forth. But we just thought it was important enough to put something together that could be seen as nationally endorsed so that it could avoid some problems. And basically the principles that we come out almost address, you'll see as we get into them, you can see for each principle the kind of problem they're meant to address. What it mainly comes down to is that good supervision is, in my mind, or what the we came out in the document, was about mutual respect and professionalism. That's what good supervision is based upon, but it's mainly about good communication. Yeah.
Well, what's the cost to the system of not having good supervision?
Very traumatic stories sometimes with students abandoning their programs, a lot of emotional strife between supervisor and supervisee, right down to legal cases and all kinds of problems. These are things we tend not to publicize. It's not something you want to put on your website as to some things happening within your school. But so when people say, what's the problem? It's often because not that there's any sort of it's really there's a lot of privacy issues involved. So, you know, they're handled quietly in dean's offices like yours and mine. And so some of the problems that can come out of it are quite devastating for people.
So we're always reporting and talking about high completion rates, short times to completion. So if we look at the other big issue, which would be funding, how does supervision rank with funding as a factor in those two particular metrics?
Good point. Good prompting. I was thinking of the real emotional trauma sometimes we have going on in our offices with when problems arise around this area. But really, yes. I mean, in terms of completion rates and time to completion, I mean, supervision has such an important role in both those stats, those performance indicators, as we call them, but also really in terms of the quality of the research which is done and ultimately ends up in theses and publications. So the more we can do to enhance the supervision to graduate students, it will be good for everybody involved, including, you know, the pursuit of knowledge. That's a grandiose scale.
Okay, well, let's dig right into this report.
Okay.
Over to Kevin.
Okay, so it comes down to, I first have to give credit where credit is due. You know, with most of these things, you don't want to spend a lot of time reinventing the wheel. So we did a lot of digging with documents and websites across the country and really use that as a significant resource. In particular, there was one, some graduate student guidelines from the University of Western Ontario, which I, in the report, in the header, I actually refer to it as a template. I wouldn't say it was a template, but a lot of the points that were in that UWO report ended up in our guiding principles. So there's 12 guiding principles. I like to refer to it as a 12-step program.
For those addicted to supervision?
Yeah, exactly, yeah, or those trying to cure themselves of it. Maybe we'll just mention each one, give a little context around them. And like I say, as they come out, some of them would say, well, that's just common sense, or that's a motherhood and apple pie sort of statement. But some of them, you know, just getting that out there is important, and some of them are not so intuitive, I'll say.
So, Kevin, before you mentioned that each of these actually probably has a related problem, so while you go through them, maybe if you can think of one of the problems, let us have them.
Yeah. Okay, so the first guiding principle is supervisor should be identified in a timely fashion. This is very important, and it's hard to say. We couldn't say should be identified within a certain period of time, because this varies dramatically with discipline. In some fields, a supervisor is identified before the student actually gets to the university. That's very common in the natural sciences and medicine, so on and so forth. In some other fields, they like the student to come into the program, be there for a year, and that sort of thing, sort out the department or the program area before somebody is selected. But whatever is the norm for the discipline, it's really that it should be done as early as possible, where you find students going a year, year and a half into their program, it really delays the whole progress. So there's the problem, is delay of progress by not having that supervisee identified early. The second one is related, and that is that supervisory committees or equivalents should be established early. And again, it was hard to write this one in all the contexts of across the country, because sometimes in some programs it is really a supervisor student almost master apprentice sort of relationship that is the norm. In others, it's a supervisory committee, quite large, 3-4 are started quite early. But we again are trying to identify, for whatever is the norm or the mechanism, that this be considered important to establish as early as possible, just like the supervisor. Sometimes it's just a secondary reader that's assigned, but that people pay attention to that and try to do it early. And that supervisory committee or second reader or whatever, that it's really the importance of having that other set of eyes involved in the supervision. Often this person or these people can act great as sounding boards and even as mitigators of conflict that might start evolving from between a supervisor and a supervisee. So another really important factor. The third principle is expectations, roles, and responsibility of graduate students and supervisors should be made clear. And very important for especially the new student coming into a graduate program, master students, or sometimes students that have done a graduate degree in another part of the world. I mean, cultures can be so different and academic systems can be so different that a clear understanding between the supervisor and the graduate student, these can be, communicated in discussions between the two. It can be embedded in handbooks and, of course, in academic calendars and so on and so forth. But really, again, early on, setting down these roles and responsibilities. And some of this can be quite detailed in terms of what are the expectations in terms of contact hours, so on and so forth, and a two-way relationship, really, between setting expectations for both the supervisor and the graduate student.
Would you be suggesting that this actually be documented and signed by everybody?
Well, yes and no. I know some universities and some programs are actually bringing in these sorts of documents early on. What we identified is that those are fine as formative sort of documents, but what we really wanted to avoid, and it's in there, is that it is important that students have informed consent and are not coerced into signing contracts which they may not agree. So that if there's this long string of responsibilities on the student's part, not so much on the supervisor's part, and they say, sign this if you want to work with me, that's really not a... there's not a level playing field there. There's a lot of a conflict of interest involved, so that we really said those are okay, but in no way should the student be coerced, and they do have to have freedom and informed consent on the issue.
Yeah, so that's a good point. Keep it at a higher level, and then it's consistent across different disciplines and different students.
Exactly.
Okay,
yeah.
Number four.
Okay. Supervisors should be readily accessible to their students, and regular monitoring and feedback should be assured.
Ah, documentation.
Yeah. Well, you know, this is one of probably what I hear as a dean as one of the greatest complaints from students, and vice versa. Sometimes supervisors saying, I can't get a hold of the student. I haven't seen the student in 3 months, so on and so forth. So, again, it could be set out from the earlier comment of expectations and roles. But, you know, if there's a regular sit-down meeting, whether that be on a daily, weekly, monthly, or whatever basis, that be clearly identified. Most programs, when we did our I can't call it an extensive survey, but in developing this, I mean, most programs have some sort of written documentation, at least on an annual basis, that the supervisor and or supervisory committee has sat down with the student and have assessed progress. And so sometimes this is written and recorded and accountable. Aside from that, you know, meeting notes on both sides, even if it's on just a weekly basis. Of course, email communication can easily be saved and that sort of thing. But it's that idea that it be regular and both sides know what this regular communication, when and where it is. Okay, moving on and trying to move on a little faster here. Number five is a no-brainer, I'd like to call it. A student-supervisor relationship should be professional.
I don't even want to know what that means.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's what you could imagine it means, is that relationships should be at arm's length. They should be academic and professional. Any sort of hanky-panky, that we don't use that language, but between supervisor and students is unacceptable. So
does that include coercion? You know, sort of bullying of students, that's a non-professional.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yes. I mean, yes. That goes beyond just being professional. I mean, that is, you know, an infringement of good behavior, and actually many policies in place in universities now I know within St. Mary's we have a nonviolent policy, and that includes things like bullying, psychological issues. So that was one that required very little debate on the part of the people that put this document together. Number six, intellectual debate and challenge should be encouraged and supported. A very good point. Sometimes both between supervisors and graduate students, the idea that debate actually goes on, and again, this can be quite culturally sensitive, is the idea, well, I don't argue with the professor. I don't challenge the professor. Well, you know, it's really important in the pursuit of knowledge that issues and items are challenged, and so that this debate be seen as healthy and not an indicator of necessarily a bad thing. Of course, the professionalism has to be there, so on and so forth. But that it was important that we get that one down as a principle.
But that also includes the notion that a supervisor can't assume, because the student hasn't said anything, that the student agrees. And so in some sense, we need to help supervisors figure out how to open the dialogue and make especially the foreign student, comfortable with arguing back, because it is a very cultural thing.
Absolutely. And it's I have a research program and have supervised students from all over the world. And it's one of the things I try to sit down to get across to them early on is that, and I've actually done some reading in different cultures about these issues that students have. And it is tough. It's tough for them. I feel sorry for them because they're there. Well, you know, I don't want to do this. And I said, well, do it anyway, because this is part of within our environment how good research goes on with intellectual challenge and debate. So yeah, it's
also one of the value addeds of coming to this country.
Yes, absolutely. Yep. The seventh one was one that we spent quite a bit of time discussing in the working group, and that is that supervisors should be mentors. Although that sounds like a motherhood and apple pie statement, it really does put on quite a bit of responsibility within this nationally endorsed document now to say that supervisors have to go beyond the role, or should go beyond the role, is the language we used, of just supervising, making sure that that coursework is kept up, that that research training goes on, that the thesis is written in a responsible and accurate and correct way, through to going to a level that involves more trust. A trusted guide is really the idea we're getting with the idea of being a mentor. And that the mentoring should be in areas not just that step out sometimes beyond the research. We have things like development of appropriate professional skills, aid in application for funding, networking opportunities. So not just like looking out for the future development of the career of the student, whether that be in academia or in other areas. So that's that one, although it sounds, you know, great, should be a mentor, it actually, like I said, we discussed a lot, but ultimately thought it was important enough that we should put it down as a guiding principle.
So maybe ultimately we need to look at guidelines for being mentors. So under that under that attitude, it came to mind this idea of getting our students to conferences and getting them to meet visitors when they come and talk about their own work to people they've never met before and things like that.
Right.
Okay, eight.
Eight. Issues of intellectual property and authorship should be made clear. And I could say clear and made this clarity done as early as possible. You hear stories as a dean of great battles breaking out when it comes to publication late in the process. The thesis has been done. The publications are now coming forward and people arguing over who is first author, second author, so on and so forth. Even more important in my mind, although not to belittle that, is the issue around intellectual property. It's very clear that there are, under natural justice, that people have a right to the intellectual property that they create. And so the idea, this has to be respected. And actually it comes in, if you ever try to protect some intellectual property, whether it be by patents or whatever, the people that are putting this patent want through for you, want to know complete disclosure. Who was involved? What was their contribution? And so it is necessary that those issues be addressed and addressed early. And we're not telling how. Some universities have their own systems. It's very clear. Other situations, it can come right down to a negotiation between the supervisor and a grad student. But again, we have a warning here is that the last line of this little section says it's inappropriate for thesis supervisors to ask students to sign over their intellectual property rights as a condition of pursuing thesis research under their supervision.
Yikes.
Yeah. Well, I mean, really, it comes down to this idea that, you know,
there's coercion.
There's coercion, exactly. And I've heard of it being done, of people saying, okay. Now, frankly, you know what? That document that was signed, I don't think would be worth the paper it was written on in terms of a legal challenge. So it's pointless anyway. But again, real coercion and an imbalance of power in a situation. So something that has to be avoided. Number nine, we're moving on. Conflict should be resolved at the lowest possible level. And this one, of course, this is just I consulted with people that manage risk and conflict resolution officers. And this is a hallmark that conflict should try to be resolved at the lowest possible level. So between the graduate student and the supervisor, students sometimes there is power issues and power imbalance issues and that sort of thing. But by jumping it up to a dean or higher, it usually just creates more problems. So try to work it out. If it doesn't have a happy resolution, then you escalate the situation. But jumping up to higher levels, I mean, there's statistics out there that show that's not helpful. Number 10, continuity is important in graduate supervision. This is the idea that supervisors sometimes do either planned in terms of sabbaticals or long periods away for field research, so on and so forth, could be away from the university for extended periods of time. And sometimes the things that are out of their control in terms of illness, accidents, so on and so forth. So this really has both an implication for individuals as supervisors, but also for institutions to have plan Bs in cases where a supervisor will be absent for periods of time beyond their control.
Yeah. So this would be something that a graduate coordinator would be concerned about in setting up an interim committee or things like that?
Exactly, yes. Yeah.
Not back to five.
Yeah, not back to five. Sorry, flipping around to the wrong page. And related to that, this idea that we need a continuity in supervision is the recognition that sometimes things don't just work out. And so the second last principle is alternative supervision should be available. And this one evoked a lot of discussion in the working group and beyond when we consulted with others, because alternative supervision should be available, but some people want to use stronger language that it must be available, so on. It was just seen as not practical. In situations, whether it's a falling out, sometimes, you know, there are irreconcilable differences between supervisors and graduate students. Sometimes, like I say, a supervisor might leave a university or God forbid, illness or death occur that would come to play. So in those cases, again, this is really an institutional point, that there should be mechanisms in place. Best efforts, that term is sometimes used to have an alternative supervisor identified, so the least negative impact upon the student, but also recognition that should a relationship between a supervisor and a graduate student break up, that it be essentially a no-fault situation for both the supervisor and the student. In cases where, you know, just alternative supervision is not possible within the university, sometimes these things can't address it if you don't have the expertise. And so, you know, you can do what you can to try and have the student transfer into another university that might have the expertise, so on and so forth. But that's why ultimately we referred to alternative supervision should be available, not necessarily that it has to be or must be available. And the last one, which is one that it wasn't just the lowest, it wasn't the last one we thought of. We actually wanted to leave this list with a very important point, and this one is, it's that students have substantial responsibilities for managing their own graduate programs. For the mature student, often this has a lot to do with maturity, but likewise understanding the system, so on and so forth. Students have to understand that they have a significant responsibility to know what is expected of them, to know what's in the academic calendar, to know what deadlines there are, so on and so forth, to be conversant with the academic requirements and these things within their program. And so this one got a lot of verbiage. The students on the working group wanted to have input on this, but in the end it was identified as something very, very important. So that's the 12-step program to better supervision.
So now who has to undergo this 12-step program? Are you suggesting that the deans put this in place, or the tri-councils, or CAGs? Like, if we really wanted this to work, what would we be doing?
Yeah, well, I mean, in terms of CAGs or the tri-councils, I mean, we've almost been there, done that, and ultimately, this document is called Guiding Principles. So the idea that, some sort of... stronger document apply nationally, I don't think it's possible. I can give you our own example of what's going on at my university, St. Mary's University. Just last month, our graduate studies committee met to discuss the document, and a motion was passed, I can't remember the language exactly, but that it be these guiding principles be adopted as guiding principles for graduate student supervision in the Faculty of Graduate Studies and Research at St. Mary's University. So that motion will be put forward at Faculty Council next month. And if it's accepted there, then it will be something that that basically we then can put in our handbooks. I mean, you can put this in your hand, anybody could put this in their student handbook, but by putting it there and identifying it as something which has been adopted, endorsed by the institution, at least at this at the faculty level, it really gives it a lot more weight. So whether it is, you know, it's adopted in its entirety, whether people use it as a reference to incorporate into their own document on graduate student supervision. It could be used in a lot of different ways, but that's the intention, is to use it as a reference document or something to be endorsed, adopted within institutions.
Do we need to be putting on workshops for students and workshops for supervisors? Like, could we be a little more proactive?
Definitely, and actually there's a couple of points in here, I can't remember which ones it's on, but that that workshops go on within these specific areas. And again, whether it's in specific areas or in general, some schools are doing a great job at this. I know Memorial University had a great workshop for new professors coming in. Other ones, it's a resource limitation, so on and so forth. But yes, definitely, you know, putting these documents together and adopting them, that's all great. But unless the message gets out there, so workshops are and seminars and tutorials are
probably best practices for each of your 12 steps.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
So one more time, Kevin, where can people find this document?
Very good. It's on the CAGS website. So if you go to www.cags.ca and then go under the publication on the menu, it'll pop up there along with, like I say, there's these documents come along. We try to do one every one or a couple of years. And so this is under that list of publications on the CAGS website.
And if you're listening to this as a podcast, you can send us your comments directly to the podcast and we'll all share them. So thanks to Kevin, who's not only written this report, but gone through it for us. And I appreciate it very much. So thanks, Kevin.
Okay, thanks, Karen.
That's it for this episode. If you'd like to get in touch with me about something you heard on this podcast or about an issue that you'd like to see covered, please email me at carolyn.waters@dal.ca. You can also leave a comment at the bottom of the page where this podcast is posted at universityaffairs.ca. Until next time, I'm Carolyn Waters, and thanks for listening.